In Haiti, a government paralyzed and gangs running rampant, there are few options for restoring security.
The situation is so severe today as we speak that maybe the only possible thing is some kind of foreign intervention.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also, the war between Israel and Hamas has choked Palestinian businesses in the West Bank. A shop owner there says people are only buying the basics.
And here in the U.S., a serious shortage of physicians. There are doctors trained abroad ready to work.
Can we create different pathways for these physicians to be able to learn what they need to learn to practice here?
Some U.S. states are trying to fast-track the licensing process for medical professionals trained overseas.
All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us today.
Haiti is going through a dangerous and uncertain moment. Last night, Prime Minister Ariel Henry said he would resign. A surge of gang violence had prevented him from returning to the country for more than a week. Now a 9-member transitional council is expected to appoint a new Haitian leader in an arrangement brokered by a bloc of Caribbean nations. They met yesterday in Jamaica, along with Biden administration officials, to discuss the rapidly changing crisis.
To learn more about the situation on the ground in Haiti, we reached out to Widlor Marincor. He's editor-in-chief of Aibo Post, and he described what life is like on the streets of Port-au-Prince today.
If you are a regular citizen and not part of any gang, you are not safe anywhere in Haiti today. Commercial planes are grounded, and we have, you know, hospitals reporting that they are low on all sorts of things, including fuel. The markets, some of them are working, although you're not seeing as many people as you would see on a normal day. But it's more proof that people need to breathe and people need some sort of relief from the chaos that the gangs have put this country in the last weeks and, frankly, in the last years.
So the streets are quieter than normal, but there are people going out and about to do their shopping at the market and things like that?
Yes, absolutely. But banks, most of them are closed. Schools are not working in the capital. The gangs are still all powerful. They still control virtually every aspect of human life in Port-au-Prince, and they still have so much power that they can determine the climate in the streets, the chaos that they are sowing, the fact that so many roads are being blocked by their presence will have an impact on you and on your life.
Are the police out on patrol?
Police officers are less present in the streets of Port-au-Prince than they are used to. And I have many sources in the police who said to me they are not present in some key places where they would normally be because they don't want to be targeted by the gangs. Many of them do not go to work. The morale at the police is, you know, at an all-time low. And also they have to defend some key places that are still under the control of what is left, of the Haitian state. I'm talking about, for instance, the national airport. I was there a couple of days ago, and I saw a heavy presence of Haitian police officers with armored cars patrolling and trying to keep this place running. About 12 police stations were attacked and destroyed, burned down by the gangs in the last 2 weeks.
And what sort of demands are these gangs making, and how organized are they in their asks?
The gang starts to make bold acts against Haitian institutions when it became clear that a multinational force would come to Haiti and fight against them. And they will make some sort of agreements if they would have amnesty or they would have pardon in exchange maybe to you know, surrender, you know, give back their guns and maybe some little form of punishment. So these are gangs that are extremely powerful, implicated in kidnappings and rape and all sorts of horrific actions. And they sense that the end of the reign of terror might come to an end, and they are doing everything they can to not have the fate that they sense is coming.
So Ariel Henry resigned or announced his resignation last night. What does it mean for people that there is officially no head of government now and effectively no government? Do you see a difference? Do things feel different?
I think most people today in Haiti, the sense in the street is they are relieved that Ariana is no longer a prime minister. But at the same time, there is also lots of uncertainty, a looming humanitarian crisis, and then many questions with regard to how the new structure would look like. That's the first thing. The second thing is how these many factions that are coming from all sorts of political philosophies would be able to work together and bring some sort of peace to the country.
With Laura Merencor is editor-in-chief of Ayibo Post in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Right now, the U.S. is treading carefully about how it might or might not get involved in Haiti. Eduardo Gamarra is a political scientist at Florida International University in Miami. He specializes in the Caribbean and outlined for us what the U.S. says it will do and what it will not do.
The U.S. has said that it will work in Haiti, but only through multilateral channels. The UN tried some measures which resulted in the convocation of a Kenya police force. And now CARICOM, the Association of Caribbean States, has gotten together and has been the most effective in working not only with the United States, but also with what's left of Haiti's political leadership.
How would you describe U.S. interests in Haiti?
There are no major economic interests in Haiti that could be of interest to the United States, given what Haiti's economy has gone through. The main interest right now, perhaps from a political point of view, is somehow stopping the flow of undocumented Haitians in through the southern border.
I mean, a lot of Haitians are wary about foreign intervention, if we can talk about that, foreign intervention by the U.S. or other nations. What is the track record when it comes to international involvement in Haiti?
Well, the U.S. has had at least 100 years of some kind of intervention in Haiti, whether it was military like at the beginning of the 20th century in 1915, or like we did in trying to return Aristide to power in 1994. So the U.S. has had a permanent presence in Haiti that by and large is resented both by the average Haitian and by the Haitian elite. Mm. There is a very recent history, for example, of a major UN force called MINUSTA that was in Haiti from 2004 until 2017. And Haitians remember it not by the reestablishment of order, but because it brought cholera and because some soldiers engaged in sexual abuse of Haitian women. So that's the memory of foreign intervention, the recent foreign intervention.
Yeah, so how does Haiti's long-term relationship with the U.S. and this pressure in the diaspora here against intervention, how does this all impact the Biden administration's choices now?
Well, the Biden administration has opted first and foremost for a multilateral approach. They are completely against any kind of direct military intervention, given the history of the past. And so in some measure, they're very cautious in how they deal with Haitian leadership in the diaspora. And since there really are no real interlocutors in Haiti, right? In fact, finding some credible interlocutors through CARICOM is the first time in which the U.S. is talking to somebody other than the prime minister who just recently resigned. So the U.S. is first and foremost doing a multilateral approach. And then I think, you know, it may in the long run consider some other type of intervention. But the most important thing that the U.S. has pledged is to fund the Kenya force. That money, however, is tied up in the lower house of our Congress. And it's tied up in this whole debate over whether we should fund Ukraine and Israel and other issues.
I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on the Kenyan intervention? Some people are saying it could turn into a real tragic situation.
The most important thing is, first, what is the nature of the mission? Is it just to stabilize the country? Or is it, as I've read elsewhere, that it's to stabilize the country and then help Haiti promote elections or hold elections? In either case, these aren't missions that are going to last 2 or 3 weeks or 3 or 4 months. You know, the longer they are, the more room for major mistakes.
Eduardo Gamarra is a political scientist at Florida International University in Miami. Late this afternoon, a Kenyan official told the New York Times the deal to send security forces still stands, but Kenya will wait until a new government is in place in Haiti.
Since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion, Ukraine has been reluctant to estimate the number of Ukrainian troops killed in action. But in late February, President Volodymyr Zelensky did give a number. He said 31,000 Ukrainians have died in 2 years of war. In the country's parliament, lawmakers are working on a bill to draft more soldiers. But Ukraine is also recruiting fighters from as far away as Latin America. Some of those new recruits are military veterans from Colombia who are not exactly signing up for ideological reasons. Manuel Rueda has more from the Colombian capital, Bogota.
Caleb is a Colombian veteran who served in his nation's military for 2 decades. After he retired, he struggled to find work. I tried to set up a small gold mine, but to do that you had to pay too many bribes, he says in a video call. That's what brought him to the battlefields of eastern Ukraine 6 months ago, at the age of 45. During the war, Caleb has been digging trenches and fighting Russians on the front lines. He also records videos of his experiences. I had never faced tanks or drones before, he says. Colombia's child's play compared to this war. For security reasons, Caleb asks us to use his military nickname. Despite the difficulties, he says he's happy to be in Ukraine. I love this country because in spite of my age, they gave me work, he says. I'm here doing what I like to do and what I've been trained for all my life. Hundreds of Colombians have enlisted in Ukraine's army recently, including many veterans. On TikTok, dozens of them are sharing videos of their experiences. One soldier, who goes by the name of Ivan, films himself firing a rocket from the trenches, while another soldier called Audel Rojas provides advice in Spanish on how to join Ukraine's army.
Venga mentalizado que viene a una guerra, que va a haber muertos, heridos.
If you come here, be prepared for war, he says. You will see many injured and many dead. Colombia has Latin America's second largest military, with around 255,000 troops. Every year, about 10,000 soldiers retire, and many have combat experience from the nation's battles against rebel groups. But there are a few programs that help veterans to set up businesses or get new jobs. That's pushed many to seek work with military contractors and also with foreign armies, says Andres Macias, professor at Bogotá's Externado University.
A regular soldier becomes part of the military at the age of 18, and by the age of 38, they can retire. So we have military personnel that are still very young and that require to continue doing or performing economic activities to survive because their pension is not as high as it could be.
Meanwhile, Ukraine is also making it easier for Colombian veterans to join its army. In November, Ukraine's Foreign Legion set up a website in Spanish targeting recruits from Latin America. It also eased language requirements. Now, soldiers who only speak Spanish can also join Ukraine's army.
I would say that it's a new way of recruiting personnel for military purposes.
Ukraine is paying fighters on the front lines around $3,000 a month, or about 5 times what a regular soldier earns in Colombia. Hernán Peña served in the Colombian army for 2 years and now runs a small coffee farm, where he makes around $300 a month.
El dinero, la verdad.
I'm basically going for the money, he says. The situation in Colombia is very tough, and if I stay here, I'll never have financial freedom. Peña registered in Ukraine's Foreign Legion in January and plans to travel there in April. I know there are risks, he says, but with the money I make there, I can save enough to start a small business. That's why I'm willing to join another country's war. This push by Ukraine to recruit foreigners comes as it struggles to get more of its own people to serve on the front lines. So, while some Ukrainians appear to be reluctant to go to the front lines, there are many in Colombia who see this war as an opportunity. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. TikTok, that launchpad for viral dance crazes and countless memes, is also, according to members of Congress, a grave threat to U.S. national security. The House is set to vote tomorrow on a bill that would ban the social media app if it doesn't cut ties with its Chinese parent company.
We can't have a foreign-controlled social media app
pushing misinformation, certainly not to our children.
That's Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Democrat from Illinois, speaking to reporters on Capitol Hill. For more on this, we reached out to Anupam Chander, a law professor at Georgetown University.
So I think the concerns are that there is Chinese national security laws that oblige Chinese companies or companies subject to jurisdiction of China to cooperate with national intelligence services. And that could be cooperation, including, for example, demanding that they turn over data from abroad. So that's the first concern. TikTok responds that it's never faced such a demand, and it would be a violation of U.S. laws should it do so. And the second concern is that there is possibility that the Chinese government might compel TikTok to circulate information, foreign propaganda, on the Chinese government's behalf.
And what about this misinformation concern? Is there evidence to back up the fact that TikTok could be, you know, a more dangerous purveyor of misinformation than, you know, other sites on the internet or TV or radio?
That's certainly a possibility. And some of the concerns have been around the Israel-Gaza war. And so essentially concerns that, you know, is TikTok pushing a pro-Gaza line to its users? And I think there's, you know, a real question as to whether or not that's the case or whether or not it's just the users themselves that are more likely to gravitate towards that approach, because TikTok is not entirely representative of the American public.
So is this a new step that Congress is taking toward banning this social media site, or have they tried to ban other ones before it?
This is a pretty monumental step. And my worry is that one, it opens a Pandora's box, because once you ban TikTok, where does that stop? I mean, do you then go to Telegram? Do you go to lots of other apps that have foreign connections in which may be obscure? And then how does China respond?
Yeah, I was going to ask. I noticed the last time TikTok reported U.S. user figures about a year ago, they said that 150 million people just in the U.S. use the app. So if it were banned, how would that impact the social media universe as a whole?
Well, we have an example of a ban of TikTok that is in effect, which is in India. In 2020, India did actually ban TikTok, and this was in response to some fighting between Indian and Chinese troops in the Himalayas. So after that, it was Facebook Reels and YouTube Shorts that benefited from the absence of TikTok in India.
TikTok has said it will not hand over data to security services or security agencies in China. But is it possible that they might actually be compelled to do that at some point?
I think there is a theoretical possibility, certainly. There are a host of ways that the Chinese government and other foreign services, intelligence services, are trying to gather information about Americans, including hacking or buying information from brokers and installing spies in companies. So there's just a whole host of opportunities for gathering data. TikTok is not the place where a huge amount of national security secrets are shared. You know, it's not the honeypot for having blackmail information either. So it's a little bit of a different app and kind of an odd choice for a national security focus.
Anupam Chander is a professor of law at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
For the past 48 hours, one story has been at the top of the agenda for most news outlets across the UK. The doctored photo of Princess Kate and her kids taken on Mother's Day. The British royal has not appeared in public since she underwent abdominal surgery in January. Her absence has led to feverish speculation about her well-being. But part of the frenzy is driven by the unusual relationship between Buckingham Palace and the British press. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us. First of all, Orla, maybe best to explain this latest incident. What happened that has led to such a frenzy of news coverage about Princess Kate in the UK?
Yeah, and I suppose we should go back a little bit to mid-January when Buckingham Palace released two statements saying that King Charles was undergoing prostate treatment and that Princess Kate was going to have planned abdominal surgery. And since then, there has been no sign of Princess Kate. So when Kensington Palace released a photo of Princess Kate and her three kids, there was widespread coverage of it. But within hours. News agencies such as Reuters, AP, said they believed that there was a problem with the photo. It looked like it had been edited, and they recommended that the photo should not be used. And of course, this led to a whole new frenzy about who really took the photo, who edited it, why it was edited, when was it really taken, and the circus has continued. There was one other photo, I should say, taken of Kate in the last 2 months, which was published by TMZ, the US website, but UK news outlets have not touched that. They haven't published it.
Why is it the case that there is a photo of Kate Middleton taken maybe by a paparazzi and the British media won't print it? We're talking about this first photo, but the US media will. I mean, does that open a window into the relationship between the media in the UK and Buckingham Palace?
It does, yeah. I mean, there's two reasons, really. First, there is a very unusual relationship between the British press and the royals. And the second issue is privacy laws. So the reality is the royal family, it receives public funding. It's open to public scrutiny. And also the palace has a brand. It has a lot of charity work that it does. So it wants the publicity. So there's this sort of give and take relationship. What you have with the press is a royal rota. So this is a small pool of accredited reporters. If the news outlets do something that irritates the royals, well, then the palace can easily remove that accreditation. The second issue is privacy laws, and UK privacy laws are they're strict. They're quite different from US privacy laws. The media can argue that it's within the public interest to publish a story about Kate or publish a photo of her, but the palace can very easily say that's a breach of her privacy.
Yeah, so I guess if you want royals news, you got to turn to US media. So many column inches in the New York Times, the Washington Post on this Kate Middleton story. Does it surprise you that the US media and many Americans are so drawn to the British royals?
I mean, I can understand it in the sort of news cycle that we're in right now. I understand that editors maybe are looking for a little bit of news that's not, you know, some devastating world event. So there is some escapism to it. I was laughing earlier. I was looking at New York Times coverage, and the headline was, you know, something along the lines of how UK papers are covering Princess Catherine. And then the New York Times itself did about four stories in the last 24 hours and on Photogate. There is an obsession. I think part of it has also been driven by Meghan Markle. The fact that there is this young woman from the US became a part of the British royal family and then exposed some fairly ugly aspects, it seems, of what goes on behind the closed doors at Buckingham Palace. And I think that has also stoked the fascination.
The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We live in a globalized era with much of the world's population residing in big, diverse urban centers. One city, though, stands out for its linguistic diversity.
New York today may be the most linguistically diverse city, not just in the world, but in the history of the world.
From Seke to Zaza, learning and preserving the endangered languages of New York City. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Before the start of the Israel-Hamas war, every week around 200,000 Palestinian laborers, mostly from the West Bank, worked in Israel. But after the October 7th attacks, the Israeli government barred most Palestinians from entering Israel, citing security concerns. That means for 5 months now, thousands of people have been out of work. Reporter Rebecca Rossman visited one small town just outside Ramallah in the West Bank to find out how people are getting by.
A soda and a single cigarette. That's about as much as this customer can afford at this local supermarket in Ein Arik, a small village just west of Ramallah. His name is Abdullah Wasfi. He tells me he's 33 years old and has three kids, two boys and a girl. He says for 14 years, he had a great job working in construction in Israel, making 14,000 shekels a month, about $4,000. But since October 7th, he's been unemployed. Now his savings are almost gone. 5 months I've been sitting at home and no one is helping us, he says angrily and storms out of the shop. Wasfi is one of hundreds in this village facing major financial insecurity after their permits to work in Israel were suspended after October 7th. Nasir Khalil, the shop owner, has been seeing the impact of all this frustration play out firsthand.
My coffee.
Before, customers were buying things like chips and Coca-Cola, he says. Now they're just buying the basics, oil, seeds, beans, and rice. He takes out his accounting book and shows me a list with dozens of customers.
So this is the list of people who are buying on credit here?
Khalil is struggling too. I have to pay rent for this shop. I have to pay for electricity, he says. I have kids who are at university. And I have to pay for all this. But he says the shop has only been taking in a fifth of the amount of daily revenue compared to before the start of Israel's war with Hamas. Before the war, Palestinian workers who held jobs in Israel contributed more than $3 billion annually to the Palestinian economy. The loss is having a severe economic impact on the Israeli economy, too.
I can say that everything has stopped.
Shai Posner is the deputy director of the Israeli Builders Association. He says the loss of Palestinian workers has brought the construction business in Israel to a near standstill.
54% of our industry has stopped completely its work since October 7. And the rest of it works on our 30-35% capacity from a normal day.
Posner and other industry leaders have appealed to the Israeli government to start letting Palestinian workers back in. But the government has come up with its own plan, one that has many workers in Ein Arik concerned. I heard that they're bringing Indians, the supermarket customer Abdullah Wasfi tells me. The Israeli government has signed agreements with several countries, including India, Sri Lanka, and Uzbekistan, to bring around 65,000 workers into the building industry. Only about 400 Indian workers have arrived in Israel so far. But builders aren't happy with this scenario. They say they already have relationships with Palestinian workers and know who's capable of what jobs. And even if the government goes ahead with this, Israeli bureaucracy means it could take up to 7 months before the thousands of workers arrive. In the meantime, low-income families like that of Musa Abdurazak's are becoming more frustrated by the day. Before October 7th, Abdurazak also had a job in construction in Israel, making around 7,000 shekels, or $2,000 a month. It's a job that gave him meaning, he says. If there's work, there's life. I liked it because it meant life, Abdurazak tells me over tea. Normally, he'd also serve me biscuits, but he can't afford them right now. The family can barely afford bread. The 38-year-old lives in a tiny home with his wife, mother, and three small children. These days, the whole family spends their time glued in front of the television watching Al Jazeera Arabic. The channel has become a 24-hour loop of the tragedies unfolding in Gaza. I have no other power than to watch TV, Abdurazak says. I'm incapable of doing anything else. Abdurazak blames Palestinian politicians for not doing more to help him and the tens of thousands of other people out of work. He's angry and fed up about his situation and depressed about what's happening in Gaza. For the World, Rebecca Rossman, Ein Arik, West Bank.
The concept of carbon offsets makes good environmental sense. You make up for the carbon emissions you're responsible for by contributing to efforts to reduce emissions. If you take a long flight, for example, you pay money to help plant trees in the Amazon. The idea makes sense, but carbon offset programs are often not executed well, and sometimes they're actually harmful. And in our ongoing effort to highlight climate solutions as part of our Big Fix series, we also dig into advertised solutions that fall short.
In Cambodia, there's a major carbon offset project that's being singled out for harming indigenous communities there. The project is supported by the government, and it allows companies or individuals to purchase carbon credits with the money aimed at supporting nature preserves. But again, it's not so simple, as Lila Goldstein reports from Cambodia. The people she spoke with asked to remain anonymous out of fear of retribution.
In the Cardamom Mountains, a local resident steers a boat along a calm waterway, pointing out the crops grown by members of his community. There's recently been increased patrolling in the area by the NGO Wildlife Alliance and Cambodian military and environmental officers, he says. It's part of a protected area that's now being enforced through a forest carbon offset project. The Chong indigenous people who farm and fish here have been restricted.
So we're seeing the boats over there are people who normally farm on the other side of the river. You can see the farms, like some like rows of planted crops. Now people are just waiting on the other side with their boats. They can't go over to farm.
When we reach land, he takes us to an area where he farms, showing us durian, banana, jackfruit, and avocado plants. His community supports conservation of forested areas, he says, but wants to continue cultivating crops in areas that have long been agricultural plots. Instead, members of his community have been evicted from their farms, harassed, and arrested. That's according to a Human Rights Watch report. Luciana Tellez Chavez is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch and the lead author of the report. She interviewed Chong indigenous people who said they were farming on land they thought belonged to them.
But the interpretation of the project is that this farming amounts to an environmental crime. Some people have also been jailed for basically just performing the activities that have formed the core of their livelihoods for generations.
This carbon offset project was able to sell credits at higher prices. That's because it received additional certifications reserved for projects that specifically benefit local and indigenous communities. But Human Rights Watch found that the process of obtaining prior consent from residents did not begin until 2.5 years after the project had already started.
I cannot imagine a more egregious problem than like reversing free, prior, and informed consent. If you say that happened and it like the opposite happened, why should I trust anything you say anywhere else?
Danny Cullenward is a climate economist and lawyer. He says the findings of the report are made even worse by the fact that some of these issues were documented in the project's own audits years before the investigation.
Everybody involved in this process has an incentive to say everything's okay. And when you dig in, sometimes that's not actually true.
These credits are certified by a U.S. nonprofit called Verra, the world's leading carbon credit certifier. Verra is supposed to confirm that the projects produce certain environmental and social benefits. The nonprofit began its own investigation of the Cambodian project after Human Rights Watch shared its preliminary findings in June. Joel Finkelstein, Verra's senior director for media and advocacy, says the allegations are appalling. However, he says Verra's auditing system is something the company can really stand behind.
It's a system designed to get to meaningful, credible, high-integrity climate impact and ethical processes in these projects. And if that was not the case here, our investigation will find that out, and there will be censures for that too.
If human rights violations can play out in a project certified by Verra, what is the value of Verra's certification?
Let me think about that. I think it's saying, what is the value of a firehouse if fires can still happen?
Verra would not provide a timeline for when its investigation will be completed and said its policy is to not comment on allegations while an investigation is ongoing. Cambodia's environment ministry did not respond to a request for comment. The NGO carrying out the project, Wildlife Alliance, said the Human Rights Watch report fundamentally distorts the reality of the project. At his family home, a Chong indigenous man in his late 50s says the rangers and officials carrying out the carbon offset project have cut down crops grown by his community. He still farms in the area, despite the patrols, but he's afraid of being spotted. He says he doesn't earn enough for his family's daily living expenses and had to take out private loans for $150. He urges the companies that are buying these credits to push for the project to stop restricting the area where he farms and to not hurt the people anymore. The authorities don't go after people with excavators, he says, but they come for people with small farms like him. For The World, I'm Lila Goldstein in Cambodia.
If you've tried to set up a doctor's appointment recently, chances are this won't surprise you. Lots of places in the U.S. just don't have enough physicians, especially rural areas. In the state of Virginia, a new bill aims to address the problem. It would create a pathway for foreign-trained doctors to continue their careers in the U.S. From Harrisonburg, Virginia, Valerie Plesch reports.
Lata Eboli-Dominique Ditomi is a physician from Cameroon, one of the more than 200,000 foreign-trained doctors living in the U.S. He followed in his parents' footsteps to become a doctor.
For me, medicine was about helping people.
After completing 7 years of medical school and earning a degree as a general practitioner in 2011, he found work in emergency medicine with Doctors Without Borders, treating displaced people from conflict and natural disasters.
And that was really, really a dream come true.
Marriage brought him to the United States in 2015, and he now lives in Maryland.
Well, at first I thought, it's a nice place for America. Anything can happen. I can even work as a nurse. I have the degree. I did more than that. I can work as a nurse. Wrong.
That's because in the U.S., in order to become a physician, even if you were one in your home country, you have to complete the United States Medical Licensing Examination, a three-step program which can cost up to $3,000, and a residency, which is highly competitive. It's a difficult, time-consuming process, but many parts of the U.S. are desperately in need of doctors now.
Hello!
Hi!
Hey, Miss Marie, how are you doing?
Hi.
Good to see you. Good to see you. So how have you been since the last time I saw you?
Dr. Rocky Fowler is a primary care physician in Harrisonburg, Virginia, located in the western part of the Shenandoah Valley. Growing up in rural Louisiana, he saw firsthand how important and challenging it was for patients to access medical care.
Then when I moved to Virginia, I learned how underserved this area is as well. I call this a desert oasis of healthcare.
Dr. Fowler's family practice sees over 3,000 patients from the Harrisonburg area. He says that when he moved here 10 years ago, he was told that the town needed 10 to 12 primary care physicians, and since then, the town has lost that number and hasn't gained any.
We have to find a way to solve this problem, and what better way to do it than with immigrant help that are already experienced, they're already knowledgeable. I mean, there has to be a way to fast-track them.
The new bill in Virginia would permit the Virginia Board of Medicine to issue a provisional license to a physician licensed in a foreign country for 2 years without completing a U.S. medical residency. After that, the license can be renewed if the physician practices in a medically underserved area in the state, like Harrisonburg. Clark Baranow is the Vice President of Government Affairs and Health Policy at the Virginia Medical Society.
That is what it's going to take to help solve our healthcare access crisis, and it is a good bill that establishes patient protections, and we think will help be a piece of that puzzle.
After 4 years with a provisional license, these doctors would be eligible to apply for a full, unrestricted license to practice medicine. Five states have already passed similar legislation with very little opposition and serve as models for Virginia's new bill, and at least 10 other states are currently considering similar bills. In Washington State, which passed similar legislation in 2020, Muhammad Khalif is the founder of the International Medical Graduates Academy, which helps foreign-trained doctors return to the medical workforce. He fled the civil war in Somalia in the 90s and came to the U.S. when he was a child. After graduating from medical school in China, he faced barriers when he returned home to Seattle.
If I wanted to work as a doctor, I didn't have a license, so everybody told me, like, you have to go through residency and get a license first before you can work as a doctor.
Tired of performing low-paying jobs to make ends meet, he brought together other international medical graduates to meet with nonprofits in Seattle to talk about their situation.
They have all the qualifications and they have the prerequisites, but nobody's giving them a chance.
Since the Washington bill was passed, his organization has helped around 20 doctors obtain licenses and find jobs in healthcare around the state.
Just given the skills that these individuals each possessed, we could see such a loss to our communities if we aren't able to help these brilliant, talented, incredible physicians get back into the system somehow.
Dr. Sarah Qureshi is a family medicine physician and associate professor and vice chair for education at the Department of Family Medicine at Georgetown University. She's been involved in integrating refugee physicians into the healthcare system.
I know that at least in the bill, we're not at all saying that anybody should just be able to come here and practice, but it's like, can we create different pathways for these physicians to be able to learn what they need to learn to practice here and utilize those skills. And that's really what this bill is about.
The Virginia bill that would provide provisional licenses to foreign-trained doctors passed unanimously in Virginia's House and Senate and is expected to be signed by the governor next month. Latte Abali Dominic Ditomi in Maryland currently works at Verizon as a service technician, which he says is a stable and well-paying job, but he still thinks about becoming a doctor again.
It's always in my mind. It's part of me. I breathe healthcare. I chew healthcare. It's in my blood.
If the bill is signed, he's ready to move to neighboring Virginia to practice medicine again. For The World, I'm Valerie Plesch, Harrisonburg, Virginia.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. There are thousands of known languages around the world, but over the next few centuries, up to half of all of them will be gone.
That's according to linguist Ross Perlin. He's the author of a new book called Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. He names New York as the most linguistically diverse city on Earth, and I started off our conversation by asking him why.
New York today may be the most linguistically diverse city, not just in the world, but in the history of the world. It's not alone. Cities increasingly everywhere are more and more linguistically diverse. Cities have always been places where people have gathered from all over, of course, and many languages have been spoken. But urbanization today, with more than half of the world's population living in cities, that marker having been crossed a few decades ago, perhaps, means that there are more and more speakers of minority, indigenous, and endangered languages coming into cities than ever before. New York is the one we know the most about. That's part of it. We've been working at the Endangered Language Alliance to map New York's languages, to substantiate the presence of over 700 of them, as I chronicle in the book. But I would love to see similar efforts, and they're starting to happen in places like London and Paris and Johannesburg.
So a person you introduce us to early on in your book is Rasmina, a 26-year-old Seke speaker living in Brooklyn. Can you tell me about Seke and why there are only, several hundred people left in the world who speak it?
Seke is a classic case of an endangered language in many ways. There are many, many languages which just have a few hundred speakers. There are many languages which have really just one or a few speakers. In the case of Seke, we're talking about a language that essentially comes from five villages in Nepal, close to the border with Tibet. It's related to Tibetan, but pretty distantly. It's not mutually intelligible with it. It's its own language, and it's in a highly multilingual area of the Himalaya. This is a place where the villages, they're over 10,000 feet, and there's a lot of out-migration for various reasons. Just within the last few decades, a substantial portion have come to New York as part of this kind of extraordinary new Himalayan diaspora here, which we've been working to document. And actually, of at most maybe 700 speakers, over 100 have actually kind of come through this one particular building, a kind of vertical village I describe in the book, which is in the middle of Brooklyn, where Rasmina has lived. And we've at this point been using a kind of Roman Latin-based alphabet modified for Seke to try to kind of represent what speakers' intuitions would be so that they can actually kind of see the subtitles on the videos that we're posting where the elders and others are speaking.
You mentioned recording elders speaking Seke because it's not a written language. How do you go about preserving a language that traditionally doesn't have a written component?
The majority of the world's languages historically have been primarily oral. Writing is really, much newer than spoken language, right, which has a much longer history. And for most people, most communities in daily life, oral language was totally sufficient. Of course, today, writing has, a major place in our societies. And, it is one component, certainly, of documenting a language, as well as potentially if you want to teach and revitalize a language. Linguists have the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is kind of like a periodic table for sounds that we can use to really specify very exactly what's happening and to transcribe. But then, it's usually important also to have what is called a practical orthography, a writing system that people themselves might actually use and be able to sort of type in and do things in.
You write in what I think is a lovely sentence, languages today are not dying natural deaths or evolving into the new forms the way Latin evolved into Romance. Now more than ever, languages are being hounded out of existence. What do you mean by that?
This is something vital to understand, I think, for people, because I'm often asks, well, haven't languages always come and gone? And, you know, aren't new languages coming into being? Well, the answer is that very few new languages are coming into being, and that the sort of event that is happening today, this massive loss of, you know, as you said, almost as much as half of the world's linguistic diversity, over 7,000 languages, is really something at an unprecedented scale that reflects very specific processes, historical processes that are ongoing, that, you know, are connected to colonialism and the spread of religions and the spread of markets and the, you know, kind of imposition of larger languages. It's not just that larger languages have been, oh, this is useful and, you know, we'll all, you know, get along better and so on, which there isn't really much evidence for. But it's actually that speakers of larger languages have been imposing their languages, and, you know, the languages that are endangered are the ones that have been marginalized, where people have been told that their languages are not real or good, or you know, if they're not written, they're somehow broken or don't have grammar. None of these things really make sense from a linguistic point of view, because there's as much, if not more, complexity often in many of the languages that we're talking about. You know, and then you have the interruption of intergenerational transmission, which is really the sort of key factor in language endangerment. It's not just about the number of speakers; it's about whether children are learning the language and whether, you know, caregivers, parents are feeling able to, comfortable about passing it on. And that's what's being interrupted so much today, because, you know, that hounding out of existence I'm talking about is pressure and the attitudes that are being sort of brought to bear on speakers of smaller languages.
Do you think that is changing at all, though? I mean, you know, there have been these waves of anti-immigrant sentiment in the U.S. going back centuries, and there was a value placed on assimilation and speaking English at home so that kids would have more opportunities than their immigrant parents. But now a lot of people really value giving their children two or more languages and raising their kids bilingual. Do you think that there is a different attitude that might help preserve some of these languages more going forward than in the past?
I hope we're seeing the beginnings of a change. And I hope that Language City is a part of that. The evidence about the benefits of raising children bilingually, the cognitive benefits, the social benefits, that's relatively recent that has been kind of well understood scientifically and promoted. And so actually, even you'll still meet people today, and certainly a few decades ago, who would say, actually, oof, I don't want to teach my kid 2-3 languages, because actually that's going to burden them. They won't end up speaking English or the larger one well enough, when it's actually been shown that it's not the case. Actually, the more multiple languages, it will benefit you in various ways.
Ross Perlin is the author of Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn.
That will do it for us today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.